The main things that were important to know. So it's a cosmological principle, which is that the universe is isotropic, which means it looks the same in all directions and homogeneous. So there's no preferred point in space. There's no center of the universe. The universe looks the same from pretty much every galaxy. And that the universe is expanding. So the velocity, according to the Hubble's law, which is actually can be derived based on these two principles, the velocity of galaxies away from us is, on average, proportional to the distance from us, with a proportionality factor called the Hubble constant, or parameter, because it's not actually constant, which is a function of time. And that can be integrated to this relationship that the distance, on average, of a galaxy away from us will increase with time according to this relationship. So A of t is the scale factor, which represents the expansion of the universe, which is related to the Hubble constant in that way. And x is called the co-moving position. And that corresponds to, if you have a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, then that describes an expanding space in which, similarly, x is the co-moving position of a point in that space. And the scale factor out in front reflects the fact that two points which are at fixed co-moving position will have a physical distance which will grow like A of t times the distance difference in their co-moving positions. And so that's how you represent the expansion of the universe in general relativity. And the fact that the universe is isotropic and homogeneous means that on average, instead of trying to describe what the geometry of space-time looks like from individual galaxies, we just smooth all those out, and we just think of all the galaxies in the universe as some constant spatial independent energy density rho with some pressure. Well, actually, for galaxies, the pressure is effectively zero, but other forms of energy density have non-trivial pressure. And that goes into this Friedman equation that determines how, at a given time, the universe is expanding. In other words, the rate of expansion is essentially measured by the Hubble constant. And the Hubble constant squared is proportional to the energy density. And this is essentially the content of Einstein's equations for this particular metric. And the local conservation, so in general relativity, conservation energy is not conserved in general. There's no global concept of energy conservation, but it is conserved locally. And in cosmological case, this conservation is reflected by this relationship here, the rate of change of the energy density. Hope it's clear that that's the energy density rho, is minus 3h times the pressure plus the energy density. And for most forms of energy density and matter in the universe, the pressure is proportional to the energy density with some constant W, which is often called the equation of state parameter. And for that particular case, it's easy to solve this relationship to find that the density scales with the scale factor as a to the minus 3, 1 plus W. And when you plug that back into Friedman's Friedman equation, that tells you the scale factor A of t is a function of time according to this relationship. Okay. So to start off today, there's a couple of issues I didn't get to last time, such as one question is, why do we believe in the Big Bang? Okay. So what do I mean by that? So basically, the reason these equations were derived in like the 1920s, and it was very quickly realized that there would be something like a Big Bang. And that's because of the basic fact that if, for any people that were thinking just about matter at the time or radiation, but regardless of whether you're looking at matter, or dust, which has equation of state W0, or radiation, like electromagnetic radiation, or very massless particles, which has equation of state 1/3, then in any case, the scale factor depends on time as some power law, okay, with the power given by this quantity here. And whenever the scale factor depends on time as a power law, the Hubble constant, H of t, is proportional to 1 over t. So if you actually work it out for a given equation of state, it goes like 2 over 3, 1 plus w t. And the point is that as you go backwards in time towards t equals 0, the scale factor goes to 0. But more significantly, the Hubble constant goes to infinity. And since the Hubble constant, not only is it a measure of the expansion of space, it's a measure of the curvature of space-time. So in particular, one component, if you take the 0, 0 Einstein component of the Einstein tensor, or similarly, if you take some combination of the Ricci tensor, this is proportional to h squared. And so if h of t becomes infinite, then the curvature of space also becomes infinite. And that's called a singularity. And so, in fact, so what we mean by the Big Bang is, in fact, is precisely this singularity. So you could define the Big Bang, if you like, as a space-like. It's called a space-like singularity because all of space becomes singular at the same time. So, in particular, if the universe is spatially flat, which means that k equals 0, then the volume of space is actually always infinite. The total volume is infinite. So when we say space is expanding, it's a little difficult to think about because the volume is infinite all the way back to the Big Bang. So when you say the physical volume at a given time, it is equal to a cubed times the co-moving volume. So by co-moving volume, I mean something like the integral dx1, dx2, dx3. And if the universe has, yep. K equals 0. K was this parameter that, so I briefly mentioned it last time. It measures the curvature of space. So I took k equals 0, which corresponds to the topology of the universe being spatially flat. So then the volume of space is actually infinite. So when we say space is expanding, we have to actually ask a more specific question about, we consider a sort of finite co-moving volume of space. Basically, galaxies remain at sort of fixed co-moving position. So if you just look at in co-moving coordinates, which are defined by the coordinates x1, x2, x3, then in co-moving position, galaxies remain at roughly fixed position. But the physical volume corresponding to that is actually that volume in co-moving space times a cubed, and that's what's getting bigger. But the total volume of the universe may in fact be infinite. Well, we don't really know that because we haven't fully measured it. We just know that it's significantly bigger than our horizon size today. Okay, so this singularity is somewhere actually where the laws of general equations of general relativity breaks down. So it's not actually a thing that we can describe in general relativity. All you're really saying is that general relativity breaks down there. We don't know what happens at that point. And so when we say that there is a Big Bang in our past and the universe existed for a finite time, what we really mean precisely is that some finite time in the past, the general relativity breaks down and then we have no idea what happens at that point. So we don't really know that the universe existed for a finite period of time. We just know that general relativity breaks down there. And in fact, the existence, although singularities The existence of singularities was realized already in the 20s. People didn't believe them for many years. And a similar situation occurred with black holes. Black hole solutions were found very early on. So I think by Schwarzschild, although he didn't call it a black hole in those days, I think around about 1917. But very early on, the solution that corresponds to a black hole was found. And a black hole also has a singularity. In fact, one that looks very much the same, a space-like singularity, although it's hidden behind the horizon of the black hole. So it's less severe. And people didn't believe these solutions. They just thought, oh, it's singular, it doesn't make any sense. And in the case of cosmological singularities, it was put forward that maybe the only reason the solution looks singular is because what you're looking at is an isotropic, completely isotropic universe. So if you take the universe today, assuming it's completely isotropic, and run it backwards into the past, then going backwards in time, it's collapsing. And so some people suggested, well, because it's because you're assuming the collapse is isotropic, that everything is focusing on a point. And that's not really true, but that's what they were thinking. So maybe it's because everything's focusing on a point that you're getting such a singular solution. And maybe if you assume that the universe today was anisotropic, so look something like that, and then run it backwards in time, then the expansion wouldn't focus at a point necessarily, and it might be regular. And so in particular in the 1960s, a group of Russians, Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lipschitz from the Landau Russian school, suggested this idea and tried to justify it. And it turns out that they thought they had justified it, but they made some mistakes in their calculations. And very soon afterwards, also in the 1960s, it was Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking who came along and using much more sophisticated methods than anybody had been using at that time, recognized that, in fact, there was no way you could sort of change your initial conditions or make things that slightly anisotropic or inhomogeneous and get rid of this singularity. They proved a set of theorems known as the singularity theorems that basically implied, given certain conditions, what you might call reasonable conditions on the energy density, become useless. Given certain reasonable conditions on the energy density, then there was inevitably you will form singularities. And that's almost ironic because it basically means that general relativity predicts its own downfall. It's a theory that predicts that inevitably has to break down. It's not a consistent theory. And so this fact, what we believe today at least, is that precisely at these points is where quantum gravity and string theory, those things you've already heard about, come in to save the day, to explain what happens to those singularities. So in particular, we hope that quantum gravity and string theory tell us what happens at the Big Bang. But, the cautionary point is we still actually don't know the universe actually has a finite age. It could have existed before that when we understand this in the context of quantum gravity. Or it could be that in this quantum regime, time doesn't exist anymore and our whole notion breaks down. All sorts of crazy ideas are flown about around this, thrown around this situation. Okay. Now, one of the most important concepts in cosmology is the notion of a horizon. And this is the existence of horizons is a direct consequence of the fact that we believe the universe existed for a finite time, or at least that there was a finite time to this Big Bang point where space-time becomes singular and breaks down. And What do I mean by a horizon? So horizon is basically the fact when if you're out at sea, your horizon is the limit to which you can see around you. And in cosmology, you generally have a horizon for the following simple fact that light travels at a finite speed. And furthermore, that speed is an upper bound on the speed that anything can travel. Nothing can travel faster than light. So in general, there can be no what we call causal influence that propagates faster than light. So we often say something like, energy or information can't travel faster than light. So you're probably familiar in special relativity of drawing a light cone. So the light cone of a particular observer, the past light cone, is the region. You draw null rays from the point, and the region inside that is the region that could have influenced this particular observer, but anything outside here would have had to have traveled faster than light to influence the observer. So this causality property is very important and is essentially what gives rise to the horizon. Because the universe existed for a finite time, okay, from the Big Bang, let's just assume the Big Bang is time zero, then there's only a finite distance that light can travel in that time. Okay. So let's work. How do we work out what that distance is? So we do that in general relativity, much as we do in special relativity. So we take this metric. Okay, which you can also write if you want. If you work, let's think we're there, and work in spherical polar coordinates. So here we've got three dimensions of space in Cartesian coordinates. We can put those in spherical polar coordinates as follows. So that's dr squared plus r squared times d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared, or something like that. There's different ways of writing that. But basically, that's a two-sphere. Everyone's familiar with that, right? No answers. Okay, I'll assume you're familiar if you say nothing. So light travels along null rays. That's what we really mean when we say at the speed of light, which are defined by the equation ds squared equals zero. So in particular, let's think about light emitted by some galaxy out there, which is coming to us directly. So think about all the light that comes towards us. This light is moving along. If it intersects us, then it's moving along radial geodesics, which connect our point. So it's traveling along curves defined by theta is zero, and so theta is a constant, and phi is a constant. So then the equation for such a trajectory is just that the change in time is a of t times the change in distance. Remember that this is still a co-moving distance. It's not the physical distance is a of t times r. R is the co-moving distance. So let's suppose this galaxy out here is some co-moving distance r0 away, and it emits the light at time. T time emitted, and we receive that today at time to for t observed. Okay, so this equation is obviously trivial to solve. We just take the a of t on the bottom and integrate. Actually, we should take the minus sign here because we're looking at light that's coming towards us. It would be the plus sign if the light was going away from us. So we integrate from the co-moving position of this galaxy to where we are, which is at r equals 0. And we integrate from the emitted time, t emitted, to our present time that we observe that light from that galaxy. That's useless. Okay, so we can solve that given a particular assumption about what our cosmology is doing. So if you remember before, the general for equation of state W, which is the ratio of the pressure to the density, the scale factor A of t evolves in time as t to the power of 2 over 3, 1 plus W. And so we can put the constant in, define it like this. Okay. That's just a sort of trivial way of putting the constant in, so that time t equals t0, the scale factor is a of t0. So we can just integrate this for an arbitrary equation of state W. And we have some integral te to t today of 1 over a t0, p0 over t to the 2 over 3, 1 plus w, dt equals r0. So that's giving us the co-moving position of the galaxy in terms of how long it takes for the light to get to us in an expanding background. So normally, of course, if the universe wasn't expanding, this would just be the obvious statement that the distance is equal to the time. I'm using, hopefully everyone realizes I'm using units where the speed of light is 1. So we could put the c back in if you want. Put the speed of light back in. So this linear relationship that the distance is equal to the velocity times time gets modified by this relationship in an expanding universe. And we can do this integral easily enough. And so I give c over a of t naught to the 2 over 3, 1 plus w. And then the t integral gives t of 1 plus 3w over 3, 1 plus w, evaluated between the limits t time emitted and time observed. OK, so. So R0 equals C over A of T naught to the 2 over 3, 1 plus W, and then T observed the 1 plus 3W over 3, 1 plus W minus T emitted the 1 plus 3W over 3, 1 plus W. Can everyone see that? It's a little, I wrote it very quickly. So, yeah? Can you read that? No? So this, it's 1 plus 3w over 3 times 1 plus w, all in brackets. Anyway, it doesn't matter too much because I'm going to simplify it in a second. So the physical distance of that galaxy, we just calculated the co-moving distance. The physical distance of the galaxy, let's call it d, is a, the scale factor today, times r0. So that's the physical distance that that galaxy is away from us today. Okay. So, what did I want to do? Oh, I remember. Okay, so that's t0, 2 over 3, 1 plus w times this combination. Let's write it out again. T emitted over 1 plus 3w over 3, 1 plus w. Now, the important point now is because that the universe has a finite age, the smallest that the emitted time could be is the time of the Big Bang, which we're using units such that that time is equal to 0. So the largest this distance could be, well, I'm actually secretly making an assumption about the W, but if we're looking, say, for radiation or matter domination, the largest this distance that the light could have traveled to us, assuming it was emitted at the Big Bang itself, is just given by setting this thing to zero. And that gives, of course, I forgot some constants. That's the problem with cosmology, is you always set everything to one. Make things simple. So there's a factor in front of here. 1 plus 3 W. So that distance, the largest distance that could be, is given by essentially roughly something like C times T times some additional factor. And this distance, so let's draw a picture of what we mean. We mean, so if we're here today, our past light cone goes out like that. And this galaxy, at some time in the past, maybe as far back as the singularity, emitted the light to us along this null ray. And we see that today. And then today, that galaxy is all the way up here at some distance, which is this factor. So it's approximately C times T0 away from us today. And this the point is that this distance is finite. So it means that up to the present time, the largest distance we could see is out here. So we call this thing the Hubble sphere. Sort of really, okay. I hope. So of course, light's traveling towards us along radial direction. So in practice, this if we look out, there's a sphere around us, which is the Hubble sphere, which is really the edge of the universe that we can see. It's not the actual edge of the universe. It's all the universe that we can possibly see at this time. And that thing is called, more precisely, it's called the particle horizon. Because it's literally the horizon of a particle. It's the horizon, it's all the universe you can see at a given time. Okay. But this is not the same as saying that the universe is finite. But it just means that we can only see a finite patch of it. So the universe may be spatially infinite, or it may be finite. We don't really know. But you, as an observer here, you can see some region of it. That's your particle horizon. But some galaxy, some observer over here has his own particle horizon. And some of that will intersect. So there'll be a region of events which both you and this galaxy can know what's going on. But then there's other regions that the other galaxy will never know, that you will know, and vice versa. So every observer has his own particle horizon. Now, actually, how big this horizon is depends on the whole evolution of the universe. So more in general, this distance, this horizon distance, is given by the scale factor today times the integral from the Big Bang, t equals 0, to t today, dt over a of t. That's just what we calculated before. Okay, so that's the distance light could have traveled if it was emitted at the Big Bang, the maximum distance. And this integral, this time actually depends on the behavior of the scale factor all the way back to the Big Bang. And in practice, the scale factor doesn't go as the same power at all times. We'll get to that a little bit later, but there are different epochs. There are epochs which are dominated by radiation, in which it goes as T to the half, I think, and matter. And so what this distance is depends on the whole history of the universe. And so we can actually, looking ahead to what we're going to talk about in the fourth lecture, which is inflation, we can see how to cheat and make this horizon even bigger by changing what the behavior of the scale factors. So crucially, the fact that this integral is finite, the integral is finite only if it converges. But it's very easy to write down a scale factor to which this integral doesn't converge. So for example, let's suppose that near the Big Bang, the scale factor increases as the square of t. Then in that case, you're doing an integral dt over t squared between 0 and t today. And so that goes like 1 over t. And so when you evaluate that at t equals 0, that gives you infinite. So when we say we've got a particle horizon, we're actually making a strong assumption about what the behavior of the universe is all the way back to the Big Bang. But it turns out you actually have to satisfy a condition in order to be able to think up a scale factor which goes as a power such that this integral diverges, so that that distance is infinite. The scale factor has to go, so convergence of the integral, let's just assume the scale factor goes as a power. The integral is going to diverge if p is greater than 1. If p equals 1, it's sort of logarithmically divergent. And when we think about that in terms of the equation of state, that corresponds to equations of state w, which is p over rho, which are less than minus 1/3. And in such a case, the scale factor a double dot is always greater than 0, which means that the universe is accelerating. And if such a period occurs in our past close to the Big Bang, we call that inflation. The acceleration of the universe literally means that the volume of the universe increases very rapidly and inflates away. And so that's what we're going to, and in fact, that's what we believe did happen in the early universe. We believe that there was a period of inflation in which the size of the universe increased by a factor of at least e to the 60. So that's about, I don't know what is e to the 60, is about like 10 to the 40, I would guess. Maybe 10 to the 30, something like that. So the volume increases by a very large number, order 10 to the 100. And that expansion occurs in a time period of about 10 to the minus 30 seconds. So in an incredibly short time period, the volume of the universe increases by a massive amount. That period in the early universe is known as inflation. And we'll talk about that in the last lecture. And it's a subject of much current research and speculation. And there are those that don't believe it makes sense and have alternative theories which are even more crazy. And it gives us something to work on. okay, so and now I'm going to switch to... So the current composition of the universe is made up of many things, but they can essentially be divided into three categories. So one is what in general we call matter, or dust components, which are things that have essentially zero pressure. And so that's basically baryons, atoms, basically us, planets, stars, sort of the visible parts of galaxies, That's basically what we normally think of when we think about energy density. That's everything. But remarkably, this stuff, everything we see, all the stars and galaxies and stuff that we see, everything that we make up, is only about 4% of the total content of the universe. So it's really a very, very small fraction. And there is another component of matter that we're pretty sure is out there, but we haven't seen it, which is called dark matter. And the fact that we haven't seen it shouldn't surprise you too much. I mean, it shouldn't surprise you too much because we only see things if they're charged. So if they have electric charge, in order to be able to see something, it has to interact with photons. And the photons interact by their electric charge. So if something is dark, then it could just mean that it's not charged. Okay? So it doesn't interact with electromagnetic radiation. And in fact, so this stuff makes up about 20% of the universe. Okay? And so in the way it makes up, it's differently distributed, but a galaxy, when we look out in space, so a galaxy like the Milky Way, when we see it in a picture, a visible picture, looks like that. So it might be kind of an elliptical galaxy or a spiral or whatever. Sometimes they have like arms like that, this sort of thing. No, they don't look like that. We go that way. Anyway, whatever. So that's the visible galaxy we see. And that stuff we see is just this 4%. But we believe that, in fact, that what if we could really see all the matter of the galaxy, it would be much bigger. And you have a halo around it, which is roughly spherical, which is made of dark matter. That's called the dark matter halo. And the mass of that is much bigger than the mass of the visible stuff, at least certainly averaged over the entire universe. That's not true of all galaxies. Some galaxies are dominated by the baryonic matter. So baryons just means things made of protons and neutrons, if you're not familiar with the term. So atoms, ordinary matter, the stuff that we're made of. So that's the matter. But even this only makes up 24% of the universe today. Now, there's also radiation. So there's light in this room. There's light from stars. That's what we see, electromagnetic radiation, visible light, microwave light, gamma ray light. So you might think, OK, this has energy density as well. The energy density, radiation has pressure as a third row, so equation of state one third. And the energy density of radiation typically scales like temperature to the four, according to the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Now, if you work out how much energy density is in radiation, it's a very small fraction. It's like less than 0.1%. It's actually smaller than that. I think that's one of the problems on the assignment. So that, and most of that radiation actually is the largest, most component of that radiation is not the light that we see in this room or from galaxies or from stars, but it's something called the cosmic microwave background. And this I'm going to get to hopefully by the end if I don't run out of time. And so this is microwave radiation. Radiation that's the same, exactly like that you produce in your microwave. And this fills the universe. So if you build a detector that looks at this radiation, so when we look out in the sky, we see, of course, stars which are dotted here and galaxies if we can look a bit farther and like that. But most of the sky is dark. Okay? But if we look in the microwave region, what you would find is that the whole sky is evenly distributed with light in the microwave band. And the only reason we can't see that is because our eyes cannot see microwave radiation. And this thing makes up most of the radiation content of the current universe, okay? But it's still a very small fraction. So where is the rest of the energy density of the universe? That is in something which we call dark energy, which is another dark thing, which is the same as saying we haven't got a clue what it is, because we haven't seen it. But we're pretty sure it's there, although if you asked a cosmologist 10 years ago, maybe less, they would probably say there's no such thing or they don't believe it's there. But today we're pretty sure. So this is something that's really being worked on at the moment. And dark energy is something, we don't know much about it, except that it makes up about 76% of the energy density of the universe today. We don't know quite what its equation of state is, but we know there are constraints. We know that the equation of state parameter W is very close to minus 1. And I think the bounds on that, so if you write W plus 1, I don't know, I can't remember what they are at the moment. It's pretty tight around that, probably like 0.05 away from that, depending on what you use. Maybe that's being optimistic. So it's something that we only very recently believe to have existed, recently being our belief of it, not that it does exist. It's existed all the way back to the Big Bang. And its equation of state is very close to minus 1. And that has so if we look at the particular case, W is exactly minus 1, and we look at the rule that the energy density scales with the scale factor as A to the minus 3, 1 plus W, then for W is minus 1, that energy density is constant. And when it's exactly minus 1, we call that thing the cosmological constant, which is often called, denoted by lambda. It's actually something that was introduced by Einstein. When Einstein first realized, Einstein, like everyone at the beginning of, you know, even when general relativity was discovered, people at that time still thought the universe was static. They didn't think it was expanding or contracting. They thought it was static. And when he found that his equations didn't allow that, he introduced this cosmological constant term, and he was able to find a static solution. But we know today, and I think you probably quickly realized afterwards that was crazy because it's a very unstable static solution. But he introduced this idea a long time ago, and for years people thought there was no such thing, but today there is very good observational evidence that something, if not precisely this, something very close to this does exist, and in fact makes up the vast majority of the energy density of the universe. So the fact that this energy density is constant is a little bit crazy given the fact that the universe is expanding, because if you think what energy density is, it's the energy per unit volume. Okay, so as the space expands, the volume gets bigger, the energy density remains constant, it looks like that you're creating energy out of nothing. And the fact that you can do that is because the fact that that doesn't contradict anything is because in general relativity, energy is not actually conserved globally. It's only conserved in a local sense. And there are other more speculative. It turns out that from fundamental physics, the existence of this thing is not so crazy. In fact, so this is also often called the vacuum energy, because quantum physics, specifically quantum field theory, tells you that something like this should actually exist. And it represents the quantum fluctuations of all matter. Because of the uncertainty principle, essentially, electrons can never be at rest. They always have some fluctuations, quantum fluctuations. And those fluctuations have energy density. And that energy density looks exactly like this. The only problem is that quantum field theory if you work out what this value is predicted by quantum field theory, it turns out to be typically about 10 to the 220 times bigger than the observed value we see today. And this fact, this is a massive problem which is known by the name of the cosmological constant problem, not surprisingly. And is a subject of much current research, much debate, speculation, crazy ideas. And it's something we really have no idea about, what this dark energy is. Dark matter, there are a lot of good candidates for that, but dark energy is something that a lot of us here are sort of working on various ideas. Some people have speculated that understanding this might require understanding quantum gravity that plays a significant role there. And other ideas are, for example, that extra dimensions of space could help solve this problem. Or that maybe just general relativity is wrong because this prediction is coming from the Friedman equation. When we infer that this energy density is there, we're assuming that the Friedman equation is true, which comes from Einstein's equations, the equations for general relativity. So it could just be that for some reason Einstein's equations are breaking down and we're inferring something that may not in fact exist. But to be honest, that's quite speculative and there's very good reasons to believe that is not true. Yep. So, yeah, there are a lot of theories of what it could be, but it's difficult to test them in practice because we don't have a lot. The observational input that gives us this tells us. So, in physics, really, to sort of understand something, you need you need to see its dynamics, and the problem is that the dynamics of this stuff, it only does anything of a time of the age of the universe. Okay, so you have to wait another age of the universe to see what it does, and you need to see the dynamics really in order to be able to say, to distinguish it, is it really a constant or is it something else? So one speculative idea is something called quintessence, which is you have some scalar field which drives some fundamental scalar field degree of freedom, a lot like the Higgs particle that people are trying to discover in accelerators. And this field has an energy density which could look very much like this. But it's difficult to probe that from our limited observations, whereas dark matter is much better understood because it undergoes, in fact, dark matter is crucial in galaxy formation. In fact, one of the strongest pieces of evidence for dark matter is that it's very difficult to understand how a galaxy forms in the way we see without it, in fact. And there's a chance that very soon dark matter may be directly observed in the LHC, Large Hadron Collider in CERN, which is going to turn on in the next year. And in fact, and the energy scales are just about right, particularly if supersymmetry is right. But dark energy is a much more difficult thing. We have no expectation to see that in a particle accelerator. We'll never see it. Well, it's unlikely we will see it directly. Okay, so there are all these different components of the universe today, and they scale in different ways. So the total energy density today, you're going to have a radiation component, which scales like 1 over a, so the scale factor to the 4, yeah, sorry.
CERN thing. How are they expecting to see dark matter when dark matter is completely different from... Like, do they think it's actually in what they're going to be colliding together, or...?
No, it'll be formed. So you collide protons and neutrons. So it's the Large Hadron Collider, so hadrons just like protons and neutrons. Like, you collide those together. Probably, I can't remember how it works, actually. So you collide two very high-energy protons with sort of TeV scale-like energies. And when these collide, it's possible to produce one of these dark matter particles. So if you think of it as a Feynman diagram, you can produce one of the... We're pretty sure that dark matter is due to some specific particle that lies beyond the standard model of particle physics. Mm-hmm. And you can produce these bi-colliding things as long as there's some interaction process, which there always is some interaction process that goes on. And whether we can produce it really depends on things like the mass of this particle and its cross-section, which measures its interaction rate. And now, of course, so the dark matter thing we tend not to see, but then this thing will decay. This is a very high-energy thing that you've produced, and very quickly it'll decay back into protons and neutrons and maybe electrons and neutrinos, depending on what that particular particle is. And you can infer indirectly its existence by its decay process. So a given particle will have a very characteristic signature of the things that it decays into. And so if you have a particular theory, you can work out what that particle decays into. And you know, so then and then people at CERN, like search through, they record all this information on the scattering processes and what they see, and they try and work backwards by looking for processes which are characteristic of specific particles, which is, you know, a hard, very tedious process, but can certainly be done. If this thing, of course, is not electrically charged, then you're unlikely, which we don't believe, then you're not going to see it directly. So you just see it by its decay products. But this very much depends on it being a particle. There was a time when people thought that black holes could make up dark matter, because we know there are black holes out there. You know, there's a black hole in the center of pretty much every galaxy. We believe that to be true now. Well, we're pretty sure that's true. And black holes do make up some component of the dark matter, but it's actually only a very small fraction. And another sort of reasonable idea, it was a good idea, is that neutrinos, so we now know that neutrinos are not massless particles traveling at the speed of light, but they have a very small mass. And because they have a small mass, they could potentially contribute to the dark matter. But that possibility is pretty much being ruled out by observations. Okay. So if you ask a particle physicist, the preferred candidate is something called the LSP, which is the lightest supersymmetric partner of the standard model. This is something that you get in supersymmetric theories, which are very popular. And they may mention, so string theory naturally gives rise to supersymmetry. And so that's probably the most favored candidate. Okay, so you've got different components. You've got radiation, you've got matter, which scales like 1/3 cubed. And then you've got dark energy, which is approximately constant. I'm going to assume it's constant, like a cosmological constant. And because they scale in different ways, then today, when we say today, the universe is mostly made up of dark energy, that statement is only true today, because as we go backwards in time, the scale factor becomes smaller. So we look at the scale factor becomes smaller, then there'll be a point at which, in fact, the matter easily dominates over the dark energy. And going further back, this term, as A goes to zero, this will clearly dominate. So going backwards in time, then you will have a period in which most of the universe will be matter. So we call that the matter-dominated era. And as you go further back, then eventually the radiation. So even though the radiation is a very small fraction today, what's in the cosmic microwave background, if you track it back in time, eventually that will dominate. And so we have something called the radiation-dominated era. But going into the future, then these terms go to zero. As the universe expands, the energy density of those goes to zero. But this thing, if it's really constant, it's really like a cosmological constant, this thing will dominate. And so you have a dark energy dominated phase, in which we are just currently stepping into. Okay, so only in the very recent history of the universe, up till very recently, and people thought that we were still in the matter-dominated era. So, but now we know that we're somewhat in the dark energy-dominated era. So as the universe continues to expand, today there's like 24% matter, but that's going to go down. It goes down as 1/8 cubed. So as the universe doubles in size, then it's going to be 1/8 of it is, and so and gets more and smaller and smaller. Okay. Now before that as well, so these are the epochs that we know exist. And then before that, before the radiation dominated era, so that if we think the Big Bang is back over here, so it's increasing that way, then there's some other, before the radiation dominated era, there's some other era in which we're not quite sure what goes on, although we believe inflation is high on the list of possibilities as to what goes on there. But generally, this is the physics here is less well known. If we go back far enough, then quantum gravity comes in, and we don't, as yet, we don't know so much what happens there. But these epochs are very well understood. And that transition between radiation and matter domination occurs at around 10 to the 11 seconds after the Big Bang. So I think a year is about 10 to the 7 seconds, something like that. So that's about 10,000 years after the Big Bang that there was a transition from radiation to matter domination. And the fact that we just happen to be today in this era of dark energy domination worries a lot of people because it seems like a hell of a coincidence. And so that's called the cosmic, or just the coincidence problem. Of all the epochs in history, life happened to form only around here, just exactly in the period of dark energy domination. A lot of people worry about why that is true, whether that has something to do, there's some relevance to dark energy in that fact. Yep.
What happens, any theories what happens once we finish the dark energy dominated era?
So if this thing really dominates, so if it's really a cosmological constant, then that will just dominate over everything from then on. And you'll just be in a period, you go in. So what happens when you have a dark energy dominated phase is the universe begins to accelerate. And so it's the fact that the universe is accelerating why we know it's true. And so it just continues to accelerate. The scale factor of the universe increases exponentially. H is the value today, it'll just keep increasing exponentially, the universe will get bigger, it'll keep getting bigger, everything will dilute away, eventually the CMB will cool down, eventually everything will cool down, matter will dissociate, and we'll just be left with, just keep going like that. The universe will be full of nothing particularly interesting, and it'll be a sort of very bland death of the universe, and that's probably the most preferred view of what's going to happen to the universe. So there'll eventually come a point where galaxies won't exist and life won't exist and stuff. But that's a long way off. So we've got a few orders of magnitude times the age of the current universe to go before then. So there's no need to worry. Okay. So. So the dynamics of the history of the universe is essentially a story about going in and out of equilibrium. Okay? And so the CMB today that we see, the cosmic microwave background, which makes up most of the radiation, has, as you've probably heard, has a perfect black body spectrum. So that means it's basically perfectly thermal. So the black body spectrum is basically just the spectrum you would expect based on the Planck law, which ultimately comes from the fact that the distribution, so radiation is made up of photons whose energy, which travel at the speed of light, so their energy is proportional to the momentum. And if you have a thermal distribution of photons, then the number density of those photons is given by the Bose-Einstein distribution. And basically, that's what we mean when we say it's black body. It's just perfectly thermal of a fixed temperature. And that temperature today, T, is about 2.73 Kelvin. Okay. So this radiation was discovered, I guess, I think it was like 67 or something like that by Penzias and Wilson. They got a Nobel Prize for it, but when they discovered it, they didn't have a clue what it was. They thought it was pigeon shit or something on the antenna. And the only reason they knew what it was is they phoned someone at Princeton up, and they said, we've got this radiation, do you know what it is? And the people at Princeton actually knew what it was. They were looking for it. They were already building an experiment to try and discover this thing. And there'd been predictions that had gone back a long way that there should be, that because of the Big Bang theory, because of reasons we'll get to, the universe should be filled with radiation of a temperature about 3 Kelvin. So these guys at Princeton knew this was there. They were building an experiment to see it, and they were scooped by Penzias and Wilson, who were not looking for this at all. But they got the Nobel Prize for it, as these things go. Okay, so this radiation has energy density, and you can work that out. You've probably done this in statistical mechanics or something. So if you have a distribution like this, Bose-Einstein distribution, that's basically the number, the distribution number density of photons. And so each photon has an energy E, and then you integrate d3 over the momentum divided by Planck's constant cubed, multiplied by a factor of 2, because there are two polarization states for photons, and that gives you the energy density. And basically, the net result of that is that this energy density scales like temperature to 4 in some units, if you use units where H bar is in CO1. We're not going to worry about that. Basically, the energy density of thermal radiation scales like temperature to the 4. So that's related to the Stefan Boltzmann law. But we also know that radiation radiation has equation of state W as a third, which means its energy density goes like 1 over A to the 4. So that basically tells us that the temperature of radiation scales like 1 over A. So something like this. So. Okay. So as we go backwards in time, radiation gets hotter. The temperature of it goes up. The spectrum remains the same, but it gets hotter and hotter. Which is connected with the fact that its energy density increases. And so this originally this picture of the universe back to this point was called the hot Big Bang model. It was just a very simple picture in which as you went backwards in time, the universe got hotter and hotter and higher densities, and that was it, and then eventually you hit the singularity. Today we know that to be not quite true. Because of what goes on here. In fact, there is a period in which the universe would have been very hot near the Big Bang, but then inflation cools it down incredibly because it expands it. And then you have to have in here a period known as reheating, where matter is created. The matter that we're made of wasn't there at the beginning, in the early stages. It was actually created from the energy density that was around in the inflationary period. And when that's created, it reheats the universe, so that the universe actually cools and then gets very suddenly very hot at a time known as reheating. But basically from then on, the universe cools. And the temperature of radiation scales like 1/A. So since in an FRW space, which expands like that, the wavelengths of this radiation, so today it's microwave radiation, just as the distance between two galaxies increases as a scale factor, the physical wavelength of radiation is actually given by the scale factor times its co-moving wavelength. So just basically because the physical distance, AFT, is proportional to AFT times the co-moving distance. And this thing is the thing that remains constant in time, the co-moving wavelength, just as galaxies remain a constant co-moving position. So at the same time that the temperature of the universe increases like 1/ the scale factor, the wavelength, if you go backwards in time and the scale factor is smaller, then the wavelength is decreasing. Okay? So that means when we look out in the sky today and we look at a CMB photon, then that photon has some redshift because of the Doppler effect that we talked about last time. So the redshift is defined as the observed wavelength divided by the emitted wavelength. And so since the co-moving wavelength remains constant, that's going to be given by the scale factor at the time that the photon is observed, which is today, we'll just call it TO, divided by the scale factor at the time it's emitted. Okay, so because that's in the past, the scale factor at the time it's emitted is always smaller, and so this ratio is always bigger than 1, and so the redshift is positive, which is the fact that, you know, we know. So just as we know galaxies are redshifted, their wavelength is the wavelength of light from them is shifted towards the red end of the spectrum. We also know that the CMB is redshifted, so it's just completely consistent with that fact. And we can also write this in terms of the temperature, or in fact just rearranging things. This is the same that the temperature today. The temperature at early times, which can be defined by its redshift, is equal to T0, 1 plus Z. So what I'm doing there is just plugging this in there. So the fact that this ratio goes like 1 plus Z means that the temperature goes like 1 plus Z. So as you go back into the past, you're looking at larger redshifts, Z, and so you're looking at higher temperatures. And so because of this fact, we actually often look at the age of the universe, not just in terms of time, but also in terms of the temperature of radiation and the redshift, that both of those things can be used as coordinates which define the age of the universe. Okay, so I've got 10 minutes left. That's pretty good. As I said before, most of the history of the universe is one about going in and out of equilibrium. Now, so what do I mean by that? So I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea that if you take, let's take a box, classic kind of experiment, filled with two gases, gas A and gas B, at some temperatures, TA and TB, which have a partition wall between them. If we take the partition wall away, then eventually what happens is that the system will thermalize, the two gases will interact with each other, and you'll reach a point where the temperature is the same, some intermediate temperature between A and B. Okay, what that intermediate temperature is depends on how much gas is in each one and the type of gas and stuff like that. But there, in saying that, which is a basic fact we learn in thermodynamics, there is a fundamental assumption that the particles, the A particles that make up gas A, whatever they are the B particles, interact with each other. Okay? But if they don't interact, in fact, they won't thermalize. So two things, two gases can exist at completely different temperatures for all time if they don't interact. There's no reason for them to thermalize. So crucial fact, in coming to equilibrium, you only, two things will only reach equilibrium, thermal equilibrium, if they interact. And this is a very important fact in the history of the universe, because there are times when things interact, and there are times when they don't. So why is that? So in any interactions that are determined, say, by particle physics. So, for example, these two gases in the universe, what we're thinking about is maybe a gas of electrons and a gas of neutrinos. Electrons and neutrinos. And those are the two things, neutrino. So everyone, is everyone familiar with neutrino? And do I have to say what? Yeah, OK. So electrons and neutrinos interact by amongst, well, they interact mostly by the weak nuclear force. And so you have various interactions like electrons and positrons. The antimatter of electrons can annihilate and form neutrinos and antineutrinos. And that's described by a Feynman diagram like this, E plus, E minus, nu e, nu bar e, and there's some intermediate particle, which is called the Z0 boson. It's like a massive gauge boson. I forgot what it's called, something like that. And there's all sorts of other interactions. Electrons can interact with neutrinos to give electrons and neutrinos. Seems a bit of a boring interaction, but in the process, they exchange energy. And similarly with antineutrinos. So these are the interactions, the fundamental particle physics interactions that go on between electrons and neutrinos. And these processes take place within the early universe. And when they take place, they're enough to keep the gas of electrons and the gas of neutrinos to have the same temperature. So that the temperature of the electrons is equal to the temperature of neutrinos. But there comes a time when that's no longer true. And that's because of a process called decoupling, which is you have to satisfy, in order for thermal equilibrium to be maintained between two different species, like electrons and neutrinos, the rate of interactions has to be greater than the Hubble time at that time that you're looking. Okay, so the Hubble time is basically a measure of one. Roughly speaking, in a given time, the Hubble parameter is 1 over the age of the universe up to that time. So it's something with inverse dimensions of inverse seconds, so it's a rate. So this, the statement that in order to maintain thermal equilibrium, this condition that the rate of interactions has to be bigger than H is simply the statement that if this is not satisfied, then in the age of the universe up to that time, there won't have been enough chance for any, more than one interaction of this type to have occurred. Okay, and that's just not enough to keep thermal equilibrium. You need lots of interaction to do that. And as soon as you're in the regime in which this is less than H, then you're saying that the average number of interactions that are going on is less than the one. Okay, in the age of the universe you had up to that point. So when that occurs, these two things decouple, which is just a way of saying that they don't interact with each other. When the two things decouple, then it no longer has to be that their temperatures have to be the same. The temperatures of electrons and temperatures of neutrinos can then evolve independently from then on. Okay, and so that's there's also earlier epochs in which these interactions. In determining the rate of interactions, in determining the rate of interactions, that depends on a number of things. So processes like this, the probability of that process is determined by something called the scattering cross section, which is denoted by sigma, which is the kind of thing that particle physicists at CERN are measuring for various different interactions. And the scattering cross section is basically a measure of the number of interactions per unit time divided by the incoming flux of particles. So what do I mean by that? So let's suppose you're interacting two particles, electron and neutrino, and you send in a flux. So you send in a beam of electrons, just as they're doing at LHC, where they're sending in a beam of protons, and these collide with the neutrinos, and you calculate on average how many interactions of a given type that you get. Those number of interactions are clearly going to be proportional to the flux that you send in. The flux is the number of electrons per unit area, per unit time, whatever it is, the normal kind of thing for a flux. And so that those number of interactions is clearly going to be proportional to that. So the scattering cross section divides out by that fact and gives a sort of pure measure of the strength of a particular type of interaction. But turning that round, in the cosmological context, you're not sending in a beam of electrons. You haven't got a particle accelerator there. You've just got a gas of electrons sitting there. So looking at it the other way, the rate of interactions, which is denoted by gamma, is equal to the cross-section, which is just some number, just some fixed constant that comes from particle physics, multiplied by the flux, which is given by the number density times the velocity. So that's the number of electrons, say, for whatever particle you're looking at, per unit volume. And that's the speed of them on average. So defined in some kinetic sense, you've got a gas of electrons with some average speed. And so the rate of those interactions, say, for electron and neutrino, is given by the cross-section times the number density times the velocity. And this thing is constant in time. But this thing is a number density, so it typically goes like 1 over the scale factor cubed. And the velocity also changes in time, because typically if you have a gas of something, if you have a gas of matter, then the average velocity will scale like the temperature, because the kinetic energy goes like V squared, and the kinetic energy will go like the temperature. So on average, the velocity will go like the square root of temperature. So the point is that the rate of interactions very much depends on time. And also the Hubble constant depends on time. So if this thing were a constant, it would always be the case that things in the past were in equilibrium, because there were, you would always be satisfying this condition. And then as h decreases, eventually you reach a point where they decouple. But in fact, it's more complicated than that because of this condition. So what happens is things be out of equilibrium, then they, so the electrons and neutrons will have different temperatures, and then they start interacting sufficiently that they can come into equilibrium, they'll have the same temperature, and then they go out of equilibrium again. And this is a sort of the kind of complicated stories that cosmologists have to work with. So as I haven't got much time left, there's one particular time in the history of the universe at which this decoupling was very important, and that's the time of recombination. And the reason this is important is because this is crucial in the story of the cosmic microwave background. And so this event occurred at about 10 to the 12 to 13 seconds after the Big Bang. So that's about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. So still quite in the early history of the universe, given that the present age of the universe is about 13 billion years. And what this process is simply, it's the time at which photons decoupled, i.e. the time at which radiation decoupled. And so, and the explanation of this is very simple, that in the very early universe, the temperature was hot. So the temperature was very large, the universe, and everything was very hot. So there were no atoms as we have them today. So an atom is made of a nucleus with electrons going around. But the temperature in the very early universe would have been sufficiently hot to strip the atom of all its electrons and ionize it. Okay, so all the atoms were in the form of ions, ionized. So in order to do that, you simply need that the typical energy, kT, has to be bigger than the binding energy of the electrons to a given atom. So in the very early universe, everything was ionized. There were no electrons, you know, there were nuclei. Well, as you go farther back, there weren't even nuclei. But at some stage, there were nuclei with, but they weren't, didn't have electrons going around. So there were no neutral atoms. Now, because of that, because a nucleus is charged, has positive charge, and electrons have negative charge, they were very strongly interacting with photons, because photons interact with charged objects. That's radiation interacts with charged objects. So by processes like where an electron and a photon scatter, proton comes in, scatters the electron off. Sometimes you emit another photon, various processes like that. But photons, which radiation, only interact with charged objects. Okay? So in the very early universe, everything was charged. We call it a plasma. And so everything was very strongly interacting with photons. And that meant that that meant one thing, that because things were interacting strongly, there was a strong equilibrium between all the different species. So the temperature of the photons was the same as the temperature of the electrons, the temperature of the nuclei, because everything was interacting very strongly. But as the universe expands, that temperature cools. And eventually there comes a point when this temperature is no longer bigger than the binding energy of atoms. And at that point, the electrons and the nuclei begin to attract each other and form neutral objects, okay, like atoms. well, mostly hydrogen atoms. So mostly protons and electrons. And then when everything is neutral, on average, you don't have a plasma anymore. You've just got some very ordinary gas of hydrogen, which is not very interesting. And light can just travel through that, because on average, it's not charged. So the scattering of light of hydrogen is very weak. And so that essentially, it's a bit more complicated than that, but that essentially is the epoch of recombination. So it's the time. So literally, recombination means the time at which electrons, and say, and protons, recombine. Although it's a terrible term because they were never combined at any point, so it's really the time at which they combine into neutral atoms, i.e., hydrogen. And so at that point, which occurred 300,000 years after the Big Bang, photons essentially decouple from all the matter there is out there in the universe, and they just travel then from then on along null trajectories. Okay, they travel through space, barely interacting with anything. The interactions they have after that we can understand reasonably well, but it's essentially nothing. And so those photons that were left over after that period of recombination make up the cosmic microwave background that we see today. So that those photons are the CMB, which is this thermal spectrum with a temperature of about 0.2273 Kelvin. And because essentially from that point on, 300,000 years ago to today, those photons don't interact with anything. When we look out in the sky and we measure a photon from the CMB, we are directly looking at the universe at its age of 300,000 years, okay? And at the time, at the age of 300,000 years, most of the physics that went on up to that point was relatively simple to understand. Most of the evolution of the universe was sort of linear, very easy to understand. And so we're looking at and this is why the CMB, which is currently being researched and data came out, was reported, most recent data, say, from the WMAP team, which is one of the, which is the current team that has a satellite out there in space which measures this cosmic microwave background, came out a couple of weeks ago at a workshop that was here, and with the latest data on this thing. And this is like probably the most important tool in cosmology. In fact, it essentially converted cosmology from a very dodgy science to one of the most successful sciences of the moment, in which we have more information than particle physicists. And it gives us a tremendous amount of detail on the early universe. So literally the early universe being the first 300,000 years. And so on that note, I'm going to stop.